This is the Berkeley Signal.
You're a mean one, Mr. Grinch. You really are a heel. You're as cuddly as a cactus. You're as charming as an eel, Mr. Grinch. You're a bad banana with a greasy black peel. Mr. Grinch, yeah, your heart's an empty home. Well, your brain is full of spiders, you got garlic in your soul, Mr. Grinch. I wouldn't touch you with a 39 and a half foot pole. I'm swinging, boys. You're a vile one, Mr. G. You got termites in that smile. You got all the tender sweetness of a seasick crocodile, Mr. G. You know, given the choice between the two of you wild, crazy cats, I'd pick the seasick crocodile. You're a foul one, Mr. Grinch. You're a nasty, wasty skunk. Well, your heart is full of unwashed socks, your soul is full of gunk, Mr. Grinch. The three words that best describe you are as follows, and I quote, stink, stank, stunk. An appalling dung heap overflowing with the most disgusting assortment of deplorable rubbish imaginable. Mangled up and tangled up nuts. You nauseate me, Mr. Grinch, with a nauseous super nuts. You're a crooked jiggy tacky and you drive a crooked house, Mr. Grinch. You're a three-decker sauerkraut and toadstool sandwich with arsenic sauce.
Oh, you're a dirty little boy.
We begin today's show looking at Syria. On Wednesday, Trump ordered the withdrawal of all 2,000 U.S. troops in Syria in a move that surprised many in Washington and around the world. Trump tweeted, quote, "We have defeated ISIS in Syria, my only reason for being there during the Trump presidency." He later posted a video on Twitter explaining the move.
Trump ordered the withdrawal despite opposition from within the White House. In September, Trump's national security advisor, John Bolton, said U.S. troops would stay in Syria until Iranian troops and its proxy forces leave. While Trump claims ISIS has been defeated, a report by the United Nations in August found up to 30,000 ISIS fighters remain in Iraq and Syria. Trump's move has been praised by some in the American peace movement and some progressive lawmakers, as well as anti-interventionist Republicans, including Senators Rand Paul and Mike Lee. But other Republican lawmakers have openly criticized Trump, like his ally, Senator Lindsey Graham, who said an American withdrawal at this time would be a big win for ISIS, Iran, Bashar al-Assad of Syria, and Russia, unquote. In addition to the fight against ISIS, Syria remains the center of multiple proxy wars involving the United States, Russia, Iran, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Israel, and other nations.
Trump's announcement to withdraw U.S. troops comes just days after Turkey threatened to launch an offensive against U.S.-backed Kurdish fighters in Syria who've been battling ISIS. Erdogan said he wants to clear Turkish fighters from east of the Euphrates. Trump's announcement also came one day after the State Department announced it had approved the sale of a $3.5 billion Patriot missile system to Turkey. One Kurdish commander told the Wall Street Journal he fears Trump's move will be a green light for Turkey to attack the Kurds. Kurds. Meanwhile, the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces criticized the U.S. withdrawal, saying it could lead to ISIS rebuilding itself. Earlier today, Russian President Vladimir Putin said he agreed with Trump's decision.
To talk more about Syria, we're joined by two guests. In Beirut, Lebanon, we're joined by Yazan Al-Sadi. He is a Syrian-Canadian writer and researcher. And in Washington, D.C., Phyllis Bennis is with us, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, has written a number of books, including most recently Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror. Let's begin with Yazan in Beirut. Your response to the surprise announcement that apparently not only shocked the political establishment in Washington, but the Pentagon and the State Department as well. Your thoughts on Trump saying, starting now, he is immediately removing 2,000 U.S. troops, beginning with State Department employees being evacuated immediately.
So, yeah, there are plenty of thoughts I have. We can start with the idea that's in my head is that I don't really think there's going to be a full withdrawal because people assume that finally the U.S. is going to be out. You might have a large chunk of the boots on the ground leaving, but it seems very clear that the American air power is going to remain. The U.S.-led coalition itself, whether it's France or the U.K., are going to be on the ground. So the idea of this full American withdrawal, I think, is a bit simplistic. And the way I see it as well, and the analogy that comes to mind, which is based off history, if we look at the history of U.S. military interventions throughout the 20th century, when it happens, it's sort of like what happens next is that it's sort of like an STD. You have herpes, where the Americans never leave. And this is true when you look at the cases of Japan or Cuba, Guantanamo Bay. So I don't think the Americans are fully withdrawing, and I think we have to be careful about that. And one key concern, obviously, is the destructive air power that has been decimating a lot of innocent civilians. Raqqa is a great example of that. What this means on the ground, I mean, what we're going to see, obviously, is that the Turks are going to leap on this, in my opinion. They're definitely going to use that opening to push forward in Membij, east of the Euphrates, and you're going to have an increase of violence there. The Assad regime itself, with its Russian and Iranian allies, are going to try and push forward as well against the PYD, or maybe the PYD will make a deal with them. But I think the situation isn't really going to be better. This doesn't mean that the U.S. soldiers should remain. I'm fully against any presence of the U.S. soldiers, just like I'm fully against the presence of the Russian soldiers. And I like how Putin talks about a legitimate government determining the presence, but I don't think Assad is legitimate. And if we follow along that line, then, well, does this mean the Saudis should remain in Yemen? I don't think so. So there's a lot that's going to happen. We have to be really careful. And I think all this, what's driving it really isn't about a mission accomplishment or caring about what's happening in Syria. I think this could be related to the multiple scandals that are brewing, multiple pressures on Trump. It could be related to so many other things, but I don't think the U.S. is ever going to leave. Like I said, it's an STD in many ways.
You've also suggested, Yazan, do you think it's likely that the U.S. might even escalate airstrikes once and if the troops are withdrawn?
Yeah, I mean, the airstrikes, there were comments by senior officials and senior military officials that talked about the continuation of airstrikes, and I think you might see an increase. Yeah, most definitely you'll see an increase because, well, the boots aren't on the ground, so they don't have to worry. And they just, you know, do what they do, and they bombard the place like they did in Mosul and Raqqa, which is utterly devastating. I don't think the solution here really is more war, personally.
And Yazan, what about how you think this might impact Russian and Assad airstrikes in areas that are not yet fully under government control?
This idea that there is U.S. conspiracy to overthrow and regime change in Syria, I don't think that's true. But, I mean, what you might see is maybe the PYD being forced to make a deal with Assad and the Russians. The PYD is the political arm of the SDF, which you mentioned earlier, the Syrian Democratic Forces, that are in the north and northeastern part of Syria all the way down to Deir ez-Zor because they took the fight to ISIS. So I feel like this is also a lesson that the PYD should have realized because any partnership with the U.S., it burns you. And this is something that we've seen in history time and time again. A lot of U.S. allies throughout the 20th century and beyond tend to get burnt because the U.S. tends to care about itself and sells you out. But this is something that most superpowers do anyways.
You mentioned the Kurds, and many are talking about conversations the president has had with Erdogan, the president of Turkey. Who knows what went on behind the scenes around the murder of Khashoggi, with Erdogan putting out the video of his murder by a Saudi hit team in Istanbul. But what are Erdogan's concerns about the U.S. working with the Kurds in Syria? And what are Turkey's plans now?
Well, Erdogan's concerns, obviously, for the Turks, we need to understand a bit of history, because there's a really long, dark history in terms of dealing with Kurdish rights and Kurdish representation. So the PYD, as a force, of a Kurdish force that is militarily strong and growing due to the vacuum that happened over the years, this was a major security concern for the Turks. So the Turks started backing various Syrian rebel groups against the PYD. So these discussions are happening. And what I find interesting is that today, the Iranian president is in Turkey, and they just had a press conference. So it seems like there might be more coordination, because the Iranians themselves aren't really interested in Kurdish autonomy, because that might affect the Kurdish community there. Neither does Iraq want that, and neither does the Syrian government in many ways. So I think there is going to be a support of the Turks going into a degree, and there might be coordination in order to ensure that there isn't going to be a spillover battle between the Turks and the Russians and everyone else. And I think the biggest victim will be the PYD for many reasons.
As you mentioned, Iranian President Rouhani is in Turkey today. What is the extent of Iranian involvement in Syria now?
I mean, the Iranian involvement has been a long, long time. I mean, the relationship was built during the 1980s. The Syrian regime was the only one that really supported Iran during the Iran-Iraq war. And this relationship has developed a long, long time. So what are the Iranians doing in Syria? They're playing as advisors. You have some fighters. They're sending in foreign fighters, whether it's Afghan militias, because they promised them nationality, or the Iraqi Shia militias that were brought in. So you have that. And the Iranians are playing sort of a political military coordinator of sorts to give backing and protection for Bashar al-Assad. Obviously, there's Hezbollah in the mix as well, which is part of that. So the Iranians are definitely trying to ensure their interests, regardless of what happens in Syria. And ultimately, and I think this is a very key point, with all these like power games played by all these countries and leaders, revolting men, they are all. The biggest losers, obviously, are communities in Syria, whether they are Kurdish, Arab, Armenian, or whatever, because the struggle for self-determination and actual freedom is really taking a pounding here.
I wanted to ask you about Trump saying that ISIS has been destroyed. Many people calling this that George W. Bush moment when he said mission accomplished in Iraq.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very Trumpian moment. I mean, he said it on Twitter. Wonderful. Great. Regardless, if the U.S. remains or leaves, what is the problem in battling ISIS is the same problem we've been seeing since the start of the global war on terror 17 years ago. And you cannot defeat extremism and terrorism with war. You need to offer alternatives. You need to deal with the core issues that are driving these things, which is political issues, social issues, economic issues, true liberation and representation for the people and communities. And this is a major failure. And the problem as well is that the global war on terror mentality, discourse, ethos has been appropriated by a lot of governments worldwide, and it's been utterly destructive. I mean, there's like a tragic reminiscence of like Al-Qaeda. It seems like Al-Qaeda was a cup of tea compared to what we're seeing today. And I do think we're going to see worse things tomorrow, because the key issues aren't being dealt with. And these powers that be are really not interested in dealing with them, because this means a complete change of the status quo. This means changing core issues, whether it's discrimination, injustice, all these things. So they're not interested. And actually, they benefit by having this continual enemy. They always benefit. And we get screwed as people.
Across the political spectrum and the political establishment, mainly the Democrats and Republicans in the Senate are attacking President Trump, especially his Republican allies. There are a number of anti-interventionists and people in the peace movement who are actually saying this is a good idea. Phyllis Bennis, your thoughts?
Well, I think the answer to your questions, Amy, is no and no. No, ISIS has not been, quote, defeated, and no, the U.S. should not remain in Syria militarily. I think that the notion of a military defeat of terrorism, we know this is, if we want to talk about fake news, that's been the classic piece of fake news for the last number of years in the so-called global war on terror. You cannot defeat terrorism, as Yazan said, militarily. Terrorism is a phenomenon that emerges out of social and economic and national and all kinds of crises in all kinds of countries. And stopping it doesn't mean playing whack-a-mole with your military, slapping them down here and they rise up again there, and slapping them down there and they rise again there. That's precisely what will happen again. It's fascinating to hear these tweets from Trump claiming, on the one hand, we've defeated ISIS and that's why we're coming out, at the same time saying, well, ISIS hasn't been defeated, but we're going to leave it to the people in, whether it's Syria, whether it's Russia, whether it's Iran, it'll be their job to wipe them out. Where you look at the distinctions between what the various presidents have said is the reason for U.S. troops being in Syria in the first place, we're there to go after ISIS. Okay, except that the Pentagon says we're there to protect our allies. In this case, it's the Kurds, who, as Yazan says, will be quickly abandoned by the U.S. John Bolton, the national security advisor, says we're in Syria to make sure that Iran doesn't build up its presence there. And the State Department says that we have to stay there because ISIS is still there. So we don't even know what was the rationale for U.S. troops to be in Syria. There certainly is no clarity on what any future rationale should be, because we know that terrorism cannot be destroyed militarily. And I think that's the fundamental question here. We do know that the warplanes and the drones are going to continue to be bombing in Syria, and it's those U.S. bombs that are creating enormous pressure and wreaking enormous havoc on the people of Syria. Again, this is something that Yazan spoke about very eloquently. When we look at Raqqa, when we look at the other cities that have been largely destroyed by U.S. bombing after being under attack, both people and the infrastructure of cities, by ISIS. This is not going to qualitatively change that on the ground. The presence of 2,000 U.S. troops, most of them special forces, that's not enough to change a military balance of forces when you're talking about thousands of fighters from all these different countries on all these different sides fighting each other to the last Syrian. The Syrians are doing the dying. It's the militaries of the U.S. and Britain and Russia and Iran and the Saudis and Qataris and Turkey, all these countries in the region, the global powers, have been fighting each other in combination in Syria since 2011. And I think in that context, the withdrawal of any one of those major military forces is important as an advantage for the people of Syria, who will have one less force bombing them. Is it going to change the political dynamics on the ground? No. We don't know whether the Kurdish forces, the YPD, is going to now turn towards renewing their old alliance with the Assad regime. That's probably the most likely possibility. This is, of course, not the first time that Kurdish forces have been first embraced and then abandoned by the United States. That's been a legacy of Kurdish history for almost a century now. So in that context, it's not going to change the situation on the ground for the population of Syria. It will temporarily shift things around for who the Kurdish forces will be relying on, whether or not the Turkish forces go into Syria and go after the Kurds that they have identified as their Kurdish enemies because of their ties to Kurdish forces inside Turkey. We don't know whether the Turks will do that. We don't know if that's part of the negotiations that are now underway between Turkey and Iran on the one hand, perhaps between Turkey and the United States on another hand, where we see a rapprochement on both sides. So Turkey may stand to gain, but there also may be a diminished level of fighting if there is less tension emerging between Turkey and the various other forces. In my book on ISIS, I identified 11 separate wars that were being waged in Syria, none of them in the interest of Syrians, but all of them causing enormous death and destruction to the people and cities of Syria. If some of those wars will be diminished by this withdrawal, that can only be a good thing.
Strike 12. We got things to do. Don't forget to
cape and don't be late. Daddy Ray, tell Rudolph I need him to lead the way, huh? I gotta get my bag with all the toys. We're going on a sleigh ride for all the little girls and boys.
Ain't nothing like a sleigh ride. Nothing like a sleigh ride.
Go ahead, go ahead. I better check it twice. It's time to find out who's been naughty or nice. It's Christmas time in town, and on my sleigh I got a brand new James Brown. Hit it, got in my bag with all those toys. Get ready, check it out with all those girls and boys. Right on.
The rise of Donald Trump has sent shockwaves through the American political landscape over the past couple of years. But his presidency is not an isolated phenomenon, at least globally. Across many countries, authoritarian leaders have exploited the grievances of resentful populations to grab power and roll back progress on many fronts. Over the last 2 years, there have been many books attempting to explain the rise of right-wing authoritarianism. One of the latest is an offering by the renowned writer Francis Fukuyama, who now joins me. Welcome to the program, Mr. Fukuyama.
Thank you very much.
You open your book saying that you couldn't have written it without the coming to power of Donald Trump. How did Trump's coming to power change everything? And for you, was it entirely unpredictable, or was this something that you saw coming?
Donald Trump is not an isolated phenomenon, as your intro suggested. In the last few years, there's been the rise of a number of authoritarian populist leaders around the world. I would include Viktor Orban in Hungary, President Erdogan in Turkey. Vladimir Putin was an early version of this, the Law and Justice Party in Poland. And then you've got quite a number of anti-immigrant, anti-EU parties nipping at the heels. You know, the latest one was a coalition of populist parties that came to power in Italy just this past year. And so this is a big change. I think that democracies have been threatened by authoritarian powers like China or Russia, external powers in the past. But this is a different phenomena insofar as the threat is really legitimately elected leaders that then begin to dismantle the rule of law institutions, the constitutional order of their societies. And it's happened really in Britain under the Brexit vote and in the Trump vote, in the two countries that were the big pillars of the liberal international order for the past 50 years. And so that's a big phenomenon. That's a big shift in global politics, and that's something that I wanted to understand better.
Now, some have pointed out that this is a function of the weaknesses of our democracy itself, of our democratic systems, and the way they're designed and how they've been exploited, even going as far as laying the blame on the feet of social media. But really, isn't the underlying phenomenon that we really need to grapple with the economic malaise, the financial distress that we've seen rising from wealth inequality over several decades.
So that, I think, is basically right. However, with a certain caveat at the end. So I do think the trigger for this has really been, as you say, the inequality that's been produced by globalization. We've, especially since the rise of Reagan and Thatcher in the 1980s, lived in an increasingly interdependent world where trade, goods, investment, people, ideas have moved across international borders. And that has actually created a tremendous amount of wealth. Global output since 1970 has more than quadrupled. And in places like China, India, Bangladesh, and so forth, lots of people have been lifted out of poverty. They've joined the middle class. And so, you know, there's a very good side to everything that's happened. But what's happened in the rich world is that a lot of jobs, particularly for less educated, less skilled workers, have migrated to Asia, to other parts of the developing world. And there's been a lot of downward mobility for people that formerly thought of themselves as middle class. And so that's reflected in these inequalities statistics where, you know, more than half of Americans are earning either as much or even less money than they were in the year 2000. So 18 years have passed. And, you know, for a very large group of Americans, they've seen no economic progress at all. So that's the part where I think inequality really has triggered this. The part that I think requires a further explanation is why this has been interpreted and benefited parties of the right rather than parties of the left. Normally, if you have a financial crisis like the one we suffered in 2008, where a bunch of big investment banks, you know, screw up and it causes a collapse that sends, you know, millions of people out of their houses, raises the unemployment rate, you know, impoverishes ordinary people, you would think that this would then trigger a left-wing upsurge. But instead, what we got in the United States was the Tea Party. And in Europe, you know, a lot of the traditional left parties, the Social Democrats in Germany, the Socialists in France, various communist parties, all have been losing votes. And they've been losing votes to right-wing nationalist parties. And so that's what needs explaining, is why economic inequality has actually benefited the right rather than the left. And that's where I think this issue of identity comes in, because those right-wing parties have been able to frame the problem in these identity terms rather than in the, you know, the classic ways that the left has framed it.
Are you suggesting that a lack of class consciousness and or class solidarity has given way to people identifying in ways that pit them against one another?
That's exactly right. This is not a new phenomenon. You know, the social anthropologist Ernest Gellner had this kind of amusing metaphor for what was going on. There was a letter that had been addressed by the Marxists to class, and instead it got delivered to an address called Nation. And this happened, you know, back in 1914. The Second International, Socialist International, thought that workers would unite around working class issues, and instead they all lined up behind Germany, Britain, France, you know, nations. And I think something similar is happening right now, that there's a class distress, but it is being interpreted, you know, the loss of a job, the loss of income is being interpreted not in, you know, these broad terms, but rather these are foreigners, they're coming to take our jobs, they're stealing our national identity. That's really the problem. And I think that's why these right-wing parties have been doing as well as they have.
Aren't the liberal democracies in many ways guilty of fomenting some of these pressures that have led to people leaving their own nations, that have led to a rise of this backlash and authoritarian leaderships?
So first of all, I disagree with the empirical observation that there hasn't been a big movement of people. If you look at the numbers of foreign-born people in OECD countries, that is to say this club of, you know, 20-some-odd rich countries, there's been a remarkable change. So basically Western Europe now, I mean, Switzerland actually tops the list. Something like 27% of its current population was born outside of Switzerland. In the United States, the figure is like 14-15%. But, you know, France, the Netherlands, Germany, Scandinavia, all of these countries have seen really massive increases in foreign-born people. And this is something they've not experienced except, you know, over the past generation. Australia, Canada both have around over 20% of their population is born outside. So there's been a tremendous movement. The other thing that I would disagree with is that this is all being driven somehow by the foreign policies of these rich countries. You take something like the Syrian civil war that was responsible for this massive wave of, you know, a couple million people trying to move to Europe. I mean, the West may have been responsible for it by inaction, you know, by not intervening earlier to unseat Bashar Assad. But basically, this was a thing that was driven by this out-of-control identity politics in Syria itself. And so there's a lot of causes, you know, I mean.
So that doesn't hold true for Iraq and Afghanistan, though, from where a lot of migrants and refugees have fled. And those wars in particular were directly driven by the West, by NATO, in Afghanistan at least.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's, again, a complicated one because there was a big terrorist operation operating there before 2001 and misruled by the Taliban. So people, you know, that civil war has really been going on since 1978. And so it's true that the United States did not solve that problem by intervening. But I think that the sources of migration out of Afghanistan way predate, you know, that American intervention. There's lots to complain about in terms of American foreign policy, both in Afghanistan and Iraq. But I think that the underlying problem is that there are a lot of people that are living in very unstable, unhappy countries that are not growing economically, that are not offering opportunities. And, you know, that's creating substantial pressure to migrate. By the way, you know, just another little empirical fact, if you think that people are not leaving, if you look within the European Union under the Schengen plan, you know, that permits free movement of people within the Schengen zone, not only has that led to these massive increases in foreign-born people living in the receiving countries like Britain and Germany and France and so forth, it's basically depopulated Eastern Europe. So Ukraine, you know, many of the Balkan countries, you know, Poland itself, have seen drops in their population of 20-30% of what they had 10 or 15 years ago. So between Poland and Britain, something like 900,000 Poles moved to Britain in a two-year period. Britain's got a population of about 60 million, so you add another 900,000 Poles in 2 years. I mean, that's an extraordinary degree of movement of people. So there's something going on in the world that is related to the fundamental openness of this liberal international order, and that in turn, I think, is what's provoked this backlash.
So we have a situation now where there are mixed populations, if you will, in many countries. Leaders like Donald Trump exploit that fear of the foreigner in order to retain power, in order to push regressive policies. What do you call for in your book is a way in which to counteract this? We talked earlier briefly about the need for class solidarity and for a strong class consciousness among working people, among people who are struggling, that transcends some of these differences. Can you explore that a little bit?
Well, I think that you need class solidarity. You also need cross-class solidarity. So if you think about the United States right now, I think that the single biggest weakness that we have in our political and social system is the degree of polarization that exists in the country. You know, you've got a red America and you've got a blue America. Because they have electorally been fairly evenly matched, it means that Congress has been paralyzed, you know, from acting on a whole bunch of issues. So it's not possible to get gun control. It's not possible to enact a universal health care system. It's not possible to do comprehensive immigration reform. All of these things, I think, are, you know, in a sense, desired by quite a lot of Americans, but because of the polarization, the system is stuck. And so I think that, yes, you need class solidarity. You also need cross-class solidarity. And I think that actually depends on widening the scope of identity to emphasize things that are more integrative, that emphasize things that Americans hold in common. And that's really the only way that you're going to get across this fundamental polarization. If you only focus on the solidarity of one side or the other, you know, that's ultimately not going to get you where you have to go, because in the end, the kinds of policies that will be necessary to substantively address inequality require a higher degree of consensus. You got to pass legislation through Congress. If you're going to have social protections, if you're going to defend, you know, the Affordable Care Act, you've got to persuade people to pay the money. You've got to persuade skeptical legislators. You know, that's the way you work things out in a democratic political system. And so I think that's the kind of political task that's in front of us.
There's some indication that plenty of well-educated whites also voted for Trump, not necessarily just the working class whites. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that, because that seems to be a force driven by the politics of racial resentment. And then back to your earlier point about having politicians that can really express policies that will benefit all Americans, we are seeing a new class of newly elected members of Congress, many of them people of color, that are expressing very strong working class solidarity and support for issues like Medicare for all Americans.
That's true. I mean, so I think that the policy, we can argue about the exact form that it takes, but again, the question is, you know, how do you build support for that? And I think that it requires, you know, reaching out beyond the circle of progressive politicians who, especially in swing states, are never going to constitute a majority of voters. And how do you get enough people on board behind that? I think that that's really, it's a doable task. It requires a certain amount of leadership. And I think that there's also an agenda, I think, of political reform, because I think there are aspects of our political system that make it much easier for a determined minority of people to block things that they don't like.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
Ya llegó la Navidad, se aproxima el año nuevo, vamos todos a estar contentos alrededor del árbol de Navidad, un regalito para papá y un regalito para mamá.
Sometimes the journalists become the story. In this often bewildering hall of mirrors in which we live, it's happening more and more.
In the time of Woodward and Bernstein and all the president's men, journalists were heroes, at least to the chattering classes. Now, some of them are villains.
Those of us who work at RT are routinely slandered. In the United States, our colleagues have to register as foreign agents, even though born and bred in the United States. Our star guest is one of the best journalists we've ever met. He's formerly with the BBC, CNN, Al Jazeera, even The Guardian. Now he's RT going underground anchor. He's Afsan Ratansi Afsan. Most people who are now in journalism grew up in the time when Woodward and Bernstein were the role models, where tackling power was the real principal purpose of journalism. Now in the senior ranks of journalism, the Woodward and Bernsteins of today are essentially criminals. How did that happen?
I mean, I should preface any remarks with the fact Noam Chomsky famously said, Woodward and Bernstein missed the point. Watergate was nothing. The real stuff was COINTELPRO. The attacks on journalism in this country, of course, are horrific. I mean, I've never seen journalism being attacked like this. In the old days, during the miners' strike in Britain in the 80s, we had people like Seamus Milne on The Guardian. We had people. Where are the people on the newspapers anymore? And how can they be attacking RT, this channel, in the way that they
do? The poachers have become the gamekeepers, no?
Yeah, exactly. And you have Andrew Marr, a top BBC journalist, literally telling the Shadow Chancellor of the Exchequer, John McDonnell, do not appear. You should. No one should appear on this channel. No one should appear on that channel.
You, according to journalists on the best liberal papers, are now the focus, a focus, let's be accurate, of the Mueller inquiry. In other words,
it's all about me.
It's all about you. You could be you could be heading for Guantanamo Bay.
As far as I know, I certainly haven't been contacted by Robert Mueller. There's an exclusive for you. Despite an award-winning journalist named
Orwell Prize winner.
Yeah, Orwell, of all people, saying that I'm a focus of the Mueller inquiry and this being repeated elsewhere. I mean, the idea of accusing journalists of somehow being involved in international conspiracies.
It wasn't just an accusation. It was an accusation expressed with glee. Let's move swiftly to what your alleged crime is. And it is, if you like, the most persecuted journalist of them all, Julian Assange. You committed, allegedly, the crime of interviewing Julian Assange. How do you feel about that now?
It was alarming, I think, at first when I heard that they'd been leaked from the Ecuadorian embassy in Knightsbridge in West London, all the people who had gone in and out, and then picked my name out that I'd left the embassy at 4:30 in the morning, and so, which I had.
More and more people on the formerly progressive left and liberal journals and so on are going farther and farther down this rabbit hole, don't you think?
Having always been a journalist, it affects me in that way. And then I think the way, the Murdoch Times turned the story around and the state-mandated BBC to say, you see, if it wasn't true, this accusation against myself, and it should be said, the director of communications of the leader of Britain's opposition, Jeremy Corbyn, that could be a Russian misinformation trick in itself to plant trick stories that are false, that discredit Russia.
Well, let's talk about the Guardian front page story that Paul Manafort had thrice visited Julian Assange in the Ecuadorian
Trump's
embassy.
Former campaign chief.
Yes, now facing a lengthy imprisonment. As it happens, I know that Manafort has never visited Julian Assange. I know that Julian Assange has never met Paul Manafort. This, though, has, though denied by all parties, and for which there is no evidence at all, has now appeared just this very day in the words of Senator Feinstein, reiterating a front-page story now entirely discredited and apparently abandoned by the
So I think I'm in that piece, and Senator Feinstein, senior senator for California, has written to Secretary of State Pompeo asking about these media reports and the importance of them. And yet, I'm sure you've had the same situation going underground. It's had Kath Viner, the editor of the Guardian newspaper, doesn't seem to have come back to anyone despite the repeated denials of WikiLeaks and indeed perhaps pending court action.
Yeah, I think they've abandoned the story, but they have not retracted it. But the point is that it was then alleged that, well, if it's perfectly untrue, perhaps the Russians planted that story in order to show us making untrue allegation. Where does this end? This is a rabbit hole.
And how does Secretary of State Pompeo respond to all this when he answers to Donald Trump, and at the same time when head of the CIA said that WikiLeaks was a hostile actor on the world stage in terms of intelligence? It is very dangerous, and I think in central London, the elite journalists, where they hang out and everything, it just goes for red as, yes, Russia did this, Russia got... They just say it as a matter of course now on media here. Russia got Trump elected, Russia got Brexit, Russia probably got Corbyn elected. I mean, there's no end to this, and these are just become truths. We know that the CIA wants a base in Ecuador, and we now know that he was being bought and sold off the Ecuadorian foreign debt to the United States. Normally, journalists should come together, of course, and show their solidarity. But newspapers here paint Julian Assange as some kind of monster, even though they benefited so hugely and financially so well. Would the Guardian newspaper exist without Julian Assange? Maybe that's the question.
All these great liberal publishing houses, The Guardian, The Washington Post, The New York Times, CNN, have all used WikiLeaks stories big time because WikiLeaks revealed some very, very, very big stories. They are just a publisher, after all. And yet those same media partners, as you put it, are now in the gang. What's going to happen to Julian? He can't stay there forever. When he comes out, it seems now certain that he'll be extradited to the United States. His fate, presumably, like Chelsea Manning, one of his main informants, decades in an American prison.
We just don't know. And I should say, in fairness to the Amazon.com, Washington Post, they did seem to try and separate themselves from the British Guardian newspaper, which has been so appalling towards WikiLeaks and to Julian Assange. We just don't know what's going to happen.
And yet, at the same time as formal journalism has gone one way, citizen journalism has multiplied like Topsy. It is now the case, isn't it, that everyone with a point of view has the means, has the ability to put it across, put it into the marketplace. So all is not lost, is it?
But there are fears, though, that one should express about some of the bigger players, like in all, as Marx would say, we know these independent outfits slowly become larger and larger.
Unfortunately, I'm old enough to have lived through a period where Russia was demonized as a communist ogre, then lionized in the time of President Yeltsin, when he was lying drunk on the floor and the West was picking Russia's pocket, lionized as the new frontier, if you like, for capitalist experimentation.
Millions may have died in Russia due to life expectancy shortening because of the IMF.
Indeed, so. And I'm now living through a period of renewed demonization. Will British relations with Russia ever improve, in your view?
I think they're going to have to because of Brexit, although, of course, that's a whole other kettle of fish whether that happens. But there are forces in our society here in Britain that are desperate for relations never, ever to be close, and it is in their financial, in their, dare I say it, corrupt interests to continually have a war with the East. Perhaps China became so powerful that their war with China has been eclipsed a little. But there are forces in this society which have to be combated at all levels to try and stop Britain from being a friend to all nations.
Afsan Ratansi, thanks for coming on the Sputnik.
the Christmas spirit is not what you drink. So how can you laugh when your own mother's hungry? And how can you smile when the reasons for smiling are wrong? And if I've just messed up your thoughtless pleasures, remember, if you wish, this is just a Christmas song. Hey, Santa, pass us that bottle, will you?
We end today's show looking at the sharp rise in deportations of Cambodian immigrants from the United States, including many who've been living in the U.S. for decades after fleeing war, U.S. bombings, and genocide under the Khmer Rouge. On Monday, an Omni air flight departed from El Paso, Texas, with 36 Cambodians on board. They were deported to the Cambodian capital, Phnom Penh. Attorneys believe it to be one of the largest deportation flights to Cambodia yet under the Trump administration.
Deportations of Cambodian immigrants are at an all-time high, with nearly 150 deportations this year, compared to 29 in 2017. These numbers are on pace to continue rising, with reported plans to remove 200 Cambodians with deportation orders each year. One man, 41-year-old Sirun from California, was scheduled to be on Monday's flight, but his deportation order was stayed Friday, and he remains in the country for now. Joining us from Berkeley, California, is Sirun's lawyer, Kevin Lowe, staff attorney in the Immigrants' Rights Program at Asian Americans Advancing Justice, Asian Law Caucus. He's been working with Cambodians living in the U.S. who are facing deportation. Lay out the issue for us, Kevin.
Yeah, sure. It's like you mentioned, these people have been in the United States for many decades. They mostly came here in the 80s after the refugee crisis in the 70s. They were all resettled by the U.S., and at that time, U.S. resettlement of refugees was terrible. Cambodians and other Southeast Asians were essentially abandoned in neighborhoods across the U.S. They were ignored. They were under-resourced. They were left to fend for themselves. And as a result of terrifying childhoods growing up in these areas, for example, one client even mentioned to me that when he was young, his dad would put him and his two sisters in the bathtub. He would tell them that it was just a game that they would play, but it was really to avoid all the drive-by shootings that would happen in the night. So after childhoods in these neighborhoods, a lot of people basically were arrested in the streets, like tagged as gang members unfairly. And then after serving their sentences, ICE would try to deport them.
So now many of these folks came here as children. So essentially, this is the only country that they have known. And similar to the Dreamers, the Latin American, many of the Latin American youth that are here, they don't really know their country they're being deported to, right?
That's right. Yeah. Almost all the clients I've spoken to, and at this point, we've spoken to hundreds of the Cambodians who are here in the U.S. When you talk to them, the majority of them, if they were born in Cambodia, they were born in Battambang province, which is the province in Cambodia that borders Thailand. And when you think about it, it's kind of a frightening thing that everyone is from there, because it's the fact that they were right by Thailand that they were able to escape to safety to Thai refugee camps along the border. When you talk to the other half of the people, you find out that they were actually born in the refugee camps themselves. Some of my clients had been in the refugee camps for so long that they have siblings that were born in each of the camps that they passed through. And then they were later accepted to the U.S., like I said, in the mid-80s.
Kevin Lowe, tell us about your client. Tell us about Sirun and what happened to him.
Yeah, so Sirun was born in Battambang province. He and his family fled Cambodia on the back of a truck. He has this terrifying story where he says he was crying so much that his parents were in this impossible situation of possibly leaving him behind in the jungle, because his crying would alert the Khmer Rouge guards that were guarding the border. Luckily, someone had a little bit of rice. They passed it to him. He ate it, and he stopped crying long enough for them to get across the border. They then spent enough years in a Thai refugee camp and then a Filipino refugee camp, such that he has a brother born in each of the camps. They were accepted to the U.S. in 1984, and he grew up in California, essentially. That was his home. And he continues to live in National City near San Diego in California. In his youth, he had only one conviction. It was when he was 19. He was driving around aimlessly with friends when two of them suggested that out of boredom that they would rob a house. Sir Un parked the car. His friends broke into the home, stole a TV, stole a few other items. And then for his trouble, for being essentially the getaway driver, Sir was given $100 as a share of the spoils and $25 in gas money. He was sentenced to serve 1 year in county jail for residential burglary. He opted to take a felony charge because he wanted his friend, who already had a strike, to avoid a second one.
Kevin, could you talk about the changes from administration to administration and how the Cambodians slated for deportation have been handled, whether it was under George Bush, President Obama, and now Trump, especially this whole issue of the getting agreement with the receiver nations to accept them?
Sure. I'll start with the repatriation agreements. So in order to deport someone out of the U.S., you can't just unilaterally decide to do so. You have to get the receiving country to accept them. And the way countries do this is through repatriation agreements, which are essentially memorandums of understanding, where the countries agree, this is how we will process the people, these are the criteria. And for Cambodia and the United States, they signed their agreement in 2002. So prior to that, Cambodians like Sir, who were ordered removed, could actually not be sent to Cambodia. They were instead released on orders of supervision and allowed to live their lives here. So Sir and many other Cambodian Americans who are here in the United States have been out for decades. They have faithfully checked in with ICE every year or maybe every 6 months. And in terms of the escalation of their deportations, it has been pretty drastic. Under Obama, every year they were deporting between 12 to 20 Cambodians. And at that rate, people were able to find time and basically, with 12 to 20 people, nonprofits and advocates around the country were able to speak with and assist the people. As soon as Donald Trump came to power, the Trump administration issued visa sanctions against Cambodia. We initially thought that this would not affect things that much, but within a month, by October of 2017, ICE had picked up around 100 Cambodians and were basically preparing them for deportation. And that's kind of the cycle we're currently in. So since October 2017, we've seen ICE raids every 4 months, and they pick up between 50 and 100 people from all across the country.
Finally, Sir Un, it sounds dramatic right through to Monday when dozens of Cambodians were deported. How did you end up preventing him from getting on that plane?
Right. So we had initially met Sir in September when he was picked up. We would prefer these situations to not be so dramatic, but because of how ICE works and how the immigration courts work, we only managed to get an emergency stay for him granted on Friday. And this was after I had filed the stay maybe a month and a half before the flight. We knew everything about the flight, like when it would leave, when it would land. And on a daily basis, I would call the Board of Immigration Appeals, where we were trying to reopen Sir Un's order. And I would leave them a voicemail on a daily basis. In the last week before he was scheduled to leave his family and his only home behind, I called the Board of Immigration Appeals on an hourly basis. I'm not a pushy person, but I would call them on the hour just to remind them that this father of two and soon to be three was about to be sent away. We actually even had to file a federal lawsuit in the Southern District of California in order to get ICE to try to force the BIA to act on a decision. It ended up being a very dramatic moment because they had already transferred my client out of the San Diego ICE facility to Arizona. We wanted them to stop the flight from Arizona to Texas, but he boarded the flight. And then midway on the flight, the ICE officers received an email. They took Sir aside. They told him, we're not sure what exactly happened, but you're not going to get off in Texas. So Sir was in a weird situation where he watched around 30-something of his countrymen essentially get off the plane in tears, ready for deportation, and he had no idea what was going
on. We just have 5 seconds. Where is he now?
I caught up with him. Seer is currently in Arizona, and we're hoping he will be released today. It's also his daughter's 4th birthday today.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
It is no secret that the Trump administration has, like, a lot going on right now. First of all, everything Trump has ever been involved in is being investigated. His company, his charity, his presidential campaign, his inauguration, his presidency. It's like he has the Midas touch, but instead of gold, everything he touches turns to crimes.
Christmas in jail, Christmas in jail, had a little too much to drink. Ain't got no bail, ain't got no bail, and I'm spending New Year's Eve in the clink. I was in the wrong lane, feeling no pain, souped my car to 75, ran right into, you can guess who, and they say I'm lucky.
Merry Christmas, Happy New Year.
They're singing down the street while everybody's having Christmas turkey. They give me bread and water to eat. Christmas in jail, Christmas in jail. Wore my shoes out pacing the floor. Got rocks in my head. I wish I was dead. Ain't gonna drink and drive no more.
Merry Christmas, Happy New Year.
They're singing down the street while everybody's having Christmas turkey. They give me bread and water to eat. Christmas in jail, Christmas in jail. Wore my shoes out pacing the floor. Got rocks in my head, I wish I was dead. Ain't gonna drink and drive no more. Ain't gonna drink and drive no more. Ain't gonna drink and drive no more.
Merry Christmas!
Really feels we're at a turning point in the Trump presidency. Not the point where he's turning himself in, but still, you can feel a change in the air right now. There's all kinds of new damning stuff. I mean, stuff you say in court kind of stuff. Coming out about Trump in court. Starting with former Trump lawyer Michael Cohen. Cohen pleaded guilty to paying off porn star Stormy Daniels and Playboy playmate Karen McDougal to influence the election. That is a felony. Hence the whole go-to-jail thing.
Old Yeller was barking up quite a storm on Twitter this morning. The president released a trilogy of tweets about his former lawyer and friend, Michael Cohen, who was sentenced to 3 years in prison for, among other things, illegal hush money payments made to Trump's mistresses during during the campaign. Trump wrote today, "I never directed Michael Cohen to break the law. He was a lawyer, and he is supposed to know the law. It's called advice of counsel, and a lawyer has great liability if a mistake is made." That's actually true. He didn't tell Michael Cohen to break the law. He paid him to break the law. He just winked and said, "I'm going to leave $130,000 on this table. It's not there when I get back. I guess it blew away." Basically, Trump is saying that when he told Michael Cohen to pay Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal, he assumed it was all legal and cool, which is interesting because I sort of remember back in April, I don't know if you remember him also saying this.
Did you know about the $130,000 payment to Stormy Daniels?
Right. First it was I never had sex with those women, then it was I never paid those women, now it's I assumed it was legal to pay those women. Next week he'll say he didn't know they were women, and that's why he asked them to take off their clothes. And on top of all that, as if you don't have enough going on, there is now a new investigation into the president's inauguration. Federal prosecutors are looking at whether Trump's inaugural committee misused funds and/or took donations in exchange for access to the new administration. Trump's inaugural team has failed to account for much of the $103 million they claim they spent on the inauguration. At this point, I think the only remaining law Donald Trump hasn't broken is gravity. But Robert Mueller has a guilty plea from a Washington consultant who used a U.S. citizen as a front so that a prominent Ukrainian oligarch could go to the inauguration, which is legal. And furthermore, what I find most damning is if they really did spend $103 million on this inauguration, how is it possible that the only band they could get to play it was Three Doors Down? I mean, the walls are closing in.
And after all those cheeseburgers, the walls don't have very far to go. Washington Post got their hands on a leaked copy of a report commissioned by the Senate Intelligence Committee, and there's some damning stuff in there. For instance, to help Trump in the election, the committee found that Russia used every major social media platform. Yes, Vladimir Putin even created his own Bitmoji.
Let's collude, American dude.
At this, he's fun. At this point, Trump faces 17 investigations, a legal assault unlike anything previously seen by any president. That's quite a distinction for Trump. No other president has had more big, beautiful investigations, okay? And they're naturals, okay, fellas? I'm telling you, if I had a dollar for everything I'm being investigated for, you'd never know because I won't show you my tax returns. But big naturals. Big.
The blues come falling. They fall like drops of rain. The blues come falling. They fall like drops of rain. I got to spend my Christmas locked up in jail again. Jail on Christmas Day again. Ain't that a pain? Oh, baby, baby, baby. Ain't that a pain? Oh, Santa, 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 come here to me. Oh, Santa, 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 come here to me in jail. Bring me a Christmas present, someone to go my bed. In jail on Christmas Day again, ain't that a pain? Oh, baby, 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 ain't that a pain? This food here, Santa, it ain't fit to eat. This food here, Santa, it ain't fit to eat. won't you come and bring me a plate of turkey meat? And here on Christmas Day, again, ain't that a pain? Oh, baby, 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 ain't that a pain? The jailhouse blues have got me. They've got the best of me. The jailhouse blues have got me. They've got the best of me. My baby doesn't love me. I've got no Christmas tree. And jail on Christmas Day, again, ain't that a pain? Oh, baby, 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 ain't that a pain?
Now, what Trump needs right now is a good lawyer. Or Rudy Giuliani. Giuliani went on the Sunday shows and insisted that no one is guilty of any crimes during the campaign because those crimes weren't crimes.
Collusion is not a crime. It doesn't exist. Paying $130,000 to Stormy whatever and paying $150,000 to the other one is not a crime. If Roger Stone gave anybody heads up about WikiLeaks leaks, that's not a crime.
Slow down. I can't write down these crimes that fast. Okay, all right, there you go. Just transcribe that, please. Okay. And what does he mean, collusion is not a crime? Okay, I understand that the actual technical name of the crime is called conspiracy to defraud the United States. Okay, that's like saying, my client is accused of murdering his neighbor, but he merely stabbed him in the aorta with a fondue fork. Fondue forking is not a crime, Your Honor. Giuliani then went after Michael Cohen's credibility.
He's changed his story four or five times.
So has the president.
President's not under oath.
That's a good point. That's a really good point, John. No, if only presidents had some sort of ceremony where a judge had to swear them in before they took office. Mueller got Trump's written answers to his questions last month, and reportedly, Mueller now wants to interview the president, but Rudy says that's not going to happen.
He is a special counsel. Does he want to interview the president?
Yeah, good luck. Over my dead body.
Trump is also fighting back himself against everything. Since Friday, Donald Trump has tweeted about China, Obamacare, the wonderful wife of Rod Blagojevich, Peter S., and the lovely Lisa Page, child separation, smugglers use the kids, witch hunt, witch hunt, witch hunt, hoax, and the Russian witch hunt hoax. It sounds really... That sounds witch hunt, witch hunt, witch hunt. That sounds like the collusion version of Duck, Duck, Goose. Witch hunt, witch hunt. Russian witch hunt hoax. Don Jr., you're it. One thing that really got Trump's goat was the plea deal Mueller struck with Trump's former lawyer and man whose doctor just delivered the bad news that he's going to live through this. Michael Cohen. Trump tweeted, remember, Michael Cohen only became a rat after the FBI did something which was absolutely unthinkable and unheard of until the witch hunt was illegally started. They broke into an attorney's office. First of all, they didn't break into his office. They had a warrant and they knocked. They're allowed to come in.
That valet just stole my car after I gave him my keys. Get him, get him.
And how about that? Rat. I like that he calls him a rat.
Never rat on your friends. And always keep your mouth shut.
Come out and shake it, you dirty yellow-bellied rat, or I'll give it to you through the door.
I didn't rat, Dad. I didn't rat.
No, you didn't rat.
Dirty yellow-bellied rat.
How you doing, President Trump? I would deeply appreciate if you would stop using mob terms like rat. It just makes wise guys like me look bad. Now, torturing a guy's head in a vice because he's short on the vig is one thing. But colluding with a foreign enemy or cheating on your third wife while she's pregnant? Well, that's just wrong. Besides, you don't see me using your words like no collusion or witch hunt or smocking gun.
Innocent people always describe their accusers as rats. Like Jesus said to Judas in the Garden of Gethsemane, "Wait to rat me out, Judy. You're going to sleep with the loaves and the fishes, see?" And Trump also got mad at the TV people.
The real scandal is the one-sided coverage, hour by hour, of networks like NBC and Democrat spin machines like Saturday Night Live. It is all nothing less than unfair news coverage, and Dem commercials should be tested in courts, can't be legal, only defame and belittle collusion.
Lord, please help Donald Trump. He's not a good man, but he is in trouble.
Joseph, Jesus, and Mary, help Mr. Trump tonight. He's a nightmare, but he's all I got.
Please send an angel to help my Donald tonight. Oh, and I would also like a Cartier watch. Thank you.
But I don't think I can do this anymore. I might finally eat a salad and explode.
What seems to be the trouble, Donald?
Who are you? Stay back.
Relax. I mean you no harm. My name is Clarence, and I was sent here from heaven. I heard you were in trouble.
It's awful. Everything's falling apart. Sometimes I wish I had never been president.
A world where you were never president, eh? I think we can arrange that.
Wow, everyone looks so different. What are those things on their faces?
Those are called smiles.
Hey, Mr. Trump, I just wanted to say Merry Christmas.
It's President Trump, Sarah.
Oh, that's a good one. No, seriously, though, I just wanted to thank you for suggesting I go into PR. I've made so much money working for so many awesome companies like Facebook and Ashley Madison and the Romaine Lettuce Association. Yeah. Merry Christmas, Tom.
Wait, Sarah isn't my press secretary?
I told you, Donald, you don't have a press secretary because you weren't elected president.
Yes, hello, Mr. Trump.
Kellyanne, my God, you look incredible, so healthy and vibrant.
Actually, that's because I'm no longer eaten from within by lies. Yes, and after we lost the campaign, the devil did give me my soul back, so... Excuse me, I have to go find my husband, who I do speak to now.
Wait, so Hillary is president?
That's right. In this reality, all she had to do to win was visit Wisconsin once.
But did they find her emails?
They did. They were all Bed Bath & Beyond coupons.
Hello, Father.
Oh, my sons, my boys, Don Jr. and Eric. Eric, is that a Rubik's Cube?
And finito. That's Italiano for finished.
What the hell is happening with Eric?
Well, since Eric doesn't run the entire Trump organization, he was able to attend adult education classes.
Uh-huh. Merry Christmas, Father. Or as they say in Funnish, Feliz Nasty Dad.
Well, still got a ways to go, buddy.
Donald, so nice to see you. How are you?
Melania, what happened to your accent?
Oh, I lost it after we got divorced. They said being around you all the time was hurting my language skills.
Well, you're still smocking hot. Are you holding up okay?
Oh, yeah. I have a huge real estate empire now. I figured, you know, if Donald can do it, anyone can do it. And I'm happily remarried to Papa John.
And who is this woman?
Oh, don't you recognize her? This is your new wife, Hernia.
She was a suitcase girl in the Serbian version of Deal or No Deal.
It's called Potato or No Potato. And I did this.
Jackpot.
I'll say, I'm an angel, but I ain't no angel. You know what I'm saying?
Mr. Trump, Merry Christmas!
Michael Cohen, shouldn't you be in jail after you flipped on me?
What? I would never ever flip on you. You're my best friend. And since it's Christmas, I just want to say that you taught me everything I know.
Oh, come on, Michael.
No, it's true. Every single thing I've done is because you've directed me to do it. And I hope everyone knows it. We're a team, like OJ and Cato, or Lyle and Eric Menendez.
Okay, Merry Christmas, Michael.
And I'll see you tomorrow at the grand opening of Trump Tower, Moscow.
But Clarence, what about my agenda, all the things I wanted to accomplish as president?
Well, that's the best part about not being president. You can still say the same stuff, build a wall, bring back coal, but you don't have to deal with the fact that all your ideas are impractical or insane. So Americans love you.
Wow, this is all so great. It's like Robert Mueller doesn't exist.
Oh, really? Hello, Mr. Trump. I've waited for this moment for a long time.
Mr. Mueller, I've been meaning to come to talk to you, but golf.
I have something for you.
Is this a subpoena or your final report?
No. Report? No, no. It's a picture of my grandson. Oh. I've been spending so much more time with him since I don't have to investigate some idiot for treason.
Wait, it sounds like you know I used to be president.
Oh, I know everything. Everything.
Wow, this night has put everything into perspective. I've had an epiphany. I guess the world does need me to be president after all.
Yeah, that was not the lesson at all.
I want to be president again. I want to be president again.
Listen, Donna. Every time a bell rings, someone you know quits or goes to jail.
So I am president again. It's a Christmas miracle.
No, not the lesson.
So Merry Christmas, everyone.
We should shut down the government over a dispute, and you want to shut it down.
Last time, Chuck, you shut it down.
No, no, no.
And then you opened it up very quickly. I don't want to do what you did.
20 times you have called for, I will shut down the government if I don't get my wall. None of us have
You
said,
want to know something? You okay, you want to put that on my... I'll take it, okay? You know what I'll say? Yes. If we don't get what we want, one way or the other, whether it's through you, through military, through anything you want to call, I will shut down the government.
Okay,
absolutely. And
disagree.
I am proud, and I'll tell you what, I am proud to shut down the government for border security, Chuck, because the people of this country don't want criminals and people that have lots of problems and drugs pouring into our country. So
I will take the mantle.
I will be the one to shut it down. I'm not going to blame you for it. The last time you shut it down, it didn't work. I will take the mantle of shutting down. And I'm going to shut it down for border security.
I believe you should.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you. Thank you.
How do you feel? Are you worried today with the indictment of Michael Cohen that this could lead back to you now? I mean, he specifically named you in court.
Now, Michael, first off, individual one isn't me, okay? That's an individual, and he's one guy. He's one guy, we don't know who he is, and Michael was talking to him. I don't know who he is. I'll never know him. I'll never know individual one. No matter how hard I stare into the mirror, I'll never know him. I'll never really know him. Melania says she knows him. What's the next question?
The next question is,
come on, let's
go. Yeah, no, I mean, obviously, I don't need to tell you this, but Democrats took back control of the House, and now, you know, they have...
Excuse me. They took the House. We took the Senate.
Yeah.
And I told Chuck, and I told Nancy the other day, and they were at me from both sides. They were spit-roasting me with questions.
Well, I would just say, you know, if I could, Mr. President, you say you took the Senate. You had the Senate.
I had the Senate, and I took it back.
You lost the House. You had the House. You lost the House.
I never really lost the House because the House always wins. And we know that from a casino. We know it from a casino with a great Joe Pesci. And he gets put in that ditch. And that's going to happen to Don Jr. if he messes up. I'll tell you that.
Can I throw out some names of some potential 2020 opponents, maybe?
You can give me anybody you want. They're all going to lose. Okay. And even if I lose, I promise you, I will not concede.
Okay. What about Beto O'Rourke? A lot of people are talking about Beto O'Rourke.
Beto. Guy's a Beto male. He's a total Beto male. And he's a lanky guy, and he's got a big old neck apple. You know that neck apple?
Yeah, the Adams. Yeah.
The neck apple. And Eve took a bite from the neck apple, and then the whole thing was screwed. So we can't have that guy.
Elizabeth Warren.
Snake.
Elizabeth Warren?
Pocahontas. Elizabeth Warren took the bait. I don't know. Let me tell you, as I know a good guy named Anthony from Massachusetts who would say, never let someone from Massachusetts run for president, ever. Doesn't anyone remember Dukakis? Dukakis? Exactly.
What about Cory Booker?
Booker, Jano. Let me tell you about Cory Booker. Guy's bald, big bald guy, and he likes the ladies. We all know that. He likes the ladies. Booker, he's got a big mouth, and he used to jump over the, he used to drive a car. TJ Booker, tough guy, TJ Booker. And that guy totally resurrected his career from Star Trek. So unbelievable.
Oh, my God.
Government scientists say there is an unparalleled period of warmth in the Arctic due to human-caused climate change. This marks the second Trump administration study in just a few weeks warning about dire climate change consequences. Remember, President Trump said he didn't believe the first one.
Frosty, we're worried about you.
Is this about my drinking?
No, you're made of snow and the earth is rapidly warming.
Fake news. I stand with President Trump on this one. MAGA!
But everyone knows global warming is a huge, imminent threat.
Relax, Snowflake. You're just brainwashed by the liberal media.
You're sweating an awful lot.
That's just season's greetings juice.
I think you're melting.
Everything's fine. Frosty the puddle, where are my eyes?
And it doesn't look like it's going to be a very jolly one for the President of the United States. Santa is bringing a stocking full of problems to Donald Trump. It has been a terrible holiday season for him. He's facing multiple criminal investigations. He's losing cabinet members. He lost the House. On top of everything else, Trump is so frustrated right now. He wants to build that wall just to bang his head against it.
Somebody snitched on me. I spilled some ink on mommy's rug. I made Tommy eat a bug. Bought some gum with a penny slug. Somebody snitched on me. Oh, I'm getting nothing for Christmas. Mommy and Daddy are mad. I'm getting nothing for Christmas. Cause I ain't been nothing but bad.
I put a tack on teacher's chair. Somebody snitched on me. I tied a knot in Susie's hair. Somebody snitched on me.
Next year we'll be going straight. Next year we'll be good, just wait. We start now, but it's too late. Somebody snitched on me. Oh, I'm getting nothing for Christmas. Mommy and Daddy are mad. I'm getting nothing for Christmas. Cause I ain't been nothing but bad. So you better be good, whatever you do. Cause if you're bad,
it's the little Saint Nick.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
Rob with Over the Edge, and I guess it's time to do a Christmas show. Yeah, Christmas show. I don't know, though. There's been a lot of animosity about just about everything, so I think even Christmas is susceptible, so we're going to... Or we might. I don't know. I think we're on the brink of a war on Christmas.
Selection, convenience, economy, savings, performance, experience, hospitality, low rates, friendly service, name brands, easy terms, affordable prices, money back guarantee, free installation, free admission, free appraisal, free alterations, free delivery, free estimates, free home trial, and free parking. No cash, no problem. No kidding. No fuss, no muss, no risk, no obligation, no red tape. No hidden charges, no down payment, no entry fee, no purchase necessary. No one will call on you. No payments or interest till December. And no parking. Limited time only, though. So act now, order today, send no money, offer good while supplies last. Two to a customer, each item sold separately. Batteries not included, mileage may vary. All sales are final, allow 6 weeks for delivery. Some items not available, some assembly required, some restrictions may apply. Shop by mail, order by phone. Try it in your home. Get one for your car. All entries become our property. Employees not eligible. Entry fees not refundable. Local restrictions apply. Void where prohibited, except in Indiana. So come on in. Come on in for a free demonstration and a free consultation with our friendly professional staff. Our courteous and knowledgeable sales representatives will help you make a selection that's just right for you and just right for your budget. And say, don't forget to pick up your free gift. A classic deluxe custom designer luxury prestige high quality premium select gourmet pocket flashlight. And if you act now, we'll include an extra added free complimentary bonus gift,
A classic deluxe custom designer luxury prestige high quality premium select gourmet leather style wallet with detachable keychain and a pencil holder. It's our way of saying thank you. And if you're not completely satisfied, you pay nothing. Simply return the unused portion for a full refund. No questions asked. It's our way of saying thank you.
Sat there, and this did for me, and I use the Psycho example again, this did for me what Psycho did as a lot younger, which is eyes open and, oh my God, we're really getting in over our heads. And that's an experience which is challenging, shocking, but mesmerizing, and I like the picture.
Well, first of all, I don't think I'm on the wrong tack with Isabella Rossellini. In the first place, the movie was shot in two halves, so she had no idea, making her part of the movie, that all of the stuff outdoors and in the daylight was going to be smarmy and campy and funny with all kinds of in-jokes. And secondly, it seems to me that we can't divorce our reactions. It's not how Isabella Rossellini reacts to the fact that she's standing there nude and humiliated on the lawn of the police captain's house with lots of people watching. It's how I react. And that's painful to me, to see a woman treated like that. And I want to know that if I'm feeling that pain, it's for a reason that the movie has, other than simply to cause pain to her.
Well, I think that the reason is that the film is a thriller and a shocker. I mean, there are people that get hurt badly in real life, and I think that this is a legitimate one. This is not a simple mad slasher
movie. Then why is it a comedy?
Because he wants to set you up. He's a director. He wants to play you like all the directors, the great directors want to do. He wants to play you like a piano. Just have you smile and swing you right into the impression. I think this is a good song.
Well, Franny Ferry waved her magic wand over the flat rose petal. And at once there was a sound like a million tiny wings flying through the air.
Thank you.
Johnny, finish your lunch. Christmas? I can't even think about it. I'm busy enough getting my children back to school.
I know it seems early, Mrs. Campbell, but since you are such a busy mother, wouldn't it be nice to have your shopping finished early this year? By starting now, you can do your Christmas shopping gradually, right from your own home. Remember, there are only 6 Avon shopping days left till Christmas.
Sounds like a good idea. Why don't you come inside? You know, I dread those crowds at Christmas. And I usually have to take the children with me, too.
Welcome to Christmas at Avon. Are you wondering, too, if September isn't a little early to start thinking about Christmas? The conversation you just heard may occur with your customer. Well, if it does, explain to her that September is just the time to start planning ahead. Because with this campaign, we begin to unveil our 1968 Christmas products.
Christians don't call it evolution because we believe it isn't something coming up out of blind nature, but something coming down from the world of light, power, knowledge beyond all nature.
Precinct calling you, and I have to inform you that your son Robert, along with another 15-year-old boy,
We've been restless and dissatisfied with ourselves and our lives. Perhaps we may not have known what caused our disquietude. We may have felt a vague yearning for inner fulfillment that outer things couldn't satisfy. Such a feeling might be considered a divine discontent, a need for assurance that our individual life is important and that our life's efforts are for a good purpose. The way to have peace of mind is found as we, in complete trust, place our life in God's care and keeping. And so it is. Amen.
Rock Street. That Rock Street is the actual place of faith that is safe. You can take the word scapper, S-A-N-T-A, that can be renamed to the word S-A-T-A. That's what we don't know when we were exposed to all these decades.
I think that it's something in San Francisco in general that has exposed all of you in some way. San Francisco is a pretty strange place, and you must admit. Well, maybe you can't admit it because you're right in the middle of it, but I'm telling you, it changes one's thought process to live in that city.
You know, every single history of the United States, the United States is the rest of the world.
Sect.
Shaitan.
Shaitan.
Short. Low-key.
This is the Berkeley Signal.